This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stock?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
But it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years
on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome. You are listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. It is finally Friday. Friday, December the 9th. We have much to talk about this evening. Good evening, everybody. I'm Guy Johnson in London. Alongside this evening, Bloomberg Opinions, Marcus Ashworth. Marcus, before we get to our chat, before we get to figuring out what is happening in the world, let me just update everybody on what is happening in the markets. The FTSE 100 today closing flat at 74.76. We're down by around 1% on the week. We have seen a pretty similar story, actually, for most of the main European markets. Stateside, the S&P is up by around 0.3%. We saw a slightly stronger than anticipated PPI print, producer price inflation, a little bit earlier on, which many are kind of viewing as the warm-up act for the big CPI print, consumer price inflation, which we're going to get out next week. Next week is absolutely huge. You've got the Bank of England, you've got the Fed, you've got the ECB, you've got inflation data from all over the place. You've got some other central banks in the form of the Norges Bank as well. So there's lots going on next week. Plus, of course, you have Sam Bankman-Fried potentially testifying in Washington, D.C. So next week could be the kind of the last big week of the year for us to watch out for. Marcus, good evening. What are we taking away from this week, though?
Well, we are lockstep. And good evening, Guy. We are lockstep in with what the dollar is doing at the moment and what the U.S. Treasury market is doing. Is, in essence, Europe, UK are not doing anything on their own, if that makes any sense. There really isn't that much divergence. Other than the fact I see oil going down, and obviously we've got a bit of noise we'll talk about later about some modest, very modest reforms in the UK. But really, we're expecting 50-50-50 next week from the Fed and then the Bank of England and the ECB. And that's got everyone in lockstep. Bonds are continuing doing extremely well. Oil is continuing to do extremely badly. And stock markets are sort of meh.
Yeah, Derek Halpeny made a good point to me a little bit earlier on. He said that if the CPI print out of the States is hot, then the market will, and then we get a hawkish Fed, those two things will kind of augment each other. But if the CPI print is soft, then the market will ignore the Fed if it's hawkish. So we'll talk about that a little bit later on. As Marcus mentioned as well, we've had a bit of a whimper in terms of regulatory reform and the City of London today from the government. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Before we do that, though, let's get some headlines with Charlie.
Thank you very much, Guy Johnson. Here's what's going on. Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt says he wants to maintain a friendly relationship with the European Union weeks after he was reported to have said the UK should seek a closer trading tie to the bloc. Speaking at an FT event, he said the events of the last year have demonstrated that we are interdependent and it's going to be a friendly relationship with our neighbours. A newspaper report of his private views about UK-EU ties sparked concern among some Conservative lawmakers that the government would try to soften the Brexit deal it agreed to 3 years ago. Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan are likely to be among the beneficiaries of the government's financial services reforms through a proposed relaxation of ring-fencing capital rules that will boost their UK savings arms. Amber Group, one of Asia's top leading crypto trading and lending platforms, is cutting jobs, scrapping retail operations, and terminating a sponsorship deal with Chelsea in the latest retrenchment to hit the digital asset sector. And Russian President Vladimir Putin says Russia may cut its oil production in response to the G7 cap on the price of its crude. He told Russian reporters today a decision on Moscow's response will be announced in a presidential decree within the next several days. That is the latest from the news desk. Guy Johnson, back to you now in London.
Charlie, thank you very much indeed. Charlie will be back in around 30 minutes' time to keep us updated on what's happening and bring us all of the headlines. Charlie mentioned it. Marcus mentioned it. This reform package that we've seen announced today by the government, they're calling them the Edinburgh reforms. A few days ago, they were going to be called Big Bang 2.0. But as it turns out, they're not really a big bang. They're not really a small bang. They're more of a whimper, actually, in terms of what we've ultimately got. We were expecting more. We were certainly expecting a Brexit dividend for the City of London. London as it hoped to mount a fight back against continental centres and, of course, New York. Now, my good friend and colleague Lizzie Burden caught up with the Economic Secretary to the Treasury and City Minister, Andrew Griffith, a little bit earlier on to get his perspective on how important these reforms really are.
I've been extremely busy working with the Chancellor to bring forward what are 30, so it's a package of 30 reforms, the Edinburgh reforms. They cover every part of financial services, from building societies, consumer credit, to our wholesale markets, how we get more listings back in London, and how we make sure that we get the right balance of investment in the UK with things like Solvency II, still within a very prudential, safe regulatory structure.
Andrew Griffith talking to Lizzie Burden a little bit earlier on. Marcus, until a few days ago, this was dubbed Big Bang 2.0. It was never really going to be a Thatcherite kind of wholesale reform of financial services. What have we actually, though, ended up with?
Well, I think, to be fair, I think Hunt realised pretty early doors he needed to drop the Big Bang aspect of it. But nonetheless, whatever we may have expected, they're also not really joined together in the sense there's not really much of a, you could have done any of these things or a lot of these things any time in the last 6 years. I mean, producing settlement dates from 2 days to 1 day, great. Making a proper tape, so a record of bond transactions, again, makes very sensible. A lot of these things are already happening in Europe. So in some senses, this certainly isn't the Singapore and Thames style, and it's not widely diverting or diverging even from the European Union, because a lot of the unbundling stuff of MiFID II it never really happened in Europe. We went through the pain here in the city, and some of the stuff which we should have done, never have done, but certainly unwound much earlier, that this is in. I mean, joined together local government pension schemes in a bigger bundle, I mean, be still my beating heart. It's all... Again, the senior managers reform, which is putting people on the spot if they're responsible or overlooking naughty stuff that goes on, that's just a consultation. I doubt that will change very much at all. That's the only stuff that might have got people a little bit upset about watering down all that sort of thing. So in some sense, I don't think Labour's got a response to this, but this isn't going to impress the city. It's not really impressing the regulator, bar this slightly strange thing of making the regulators focus on growth, which they'll clearly ignore. And, in some senses, it's just sort of, I don't know what it is, it's a fig leaf of something or other. I don't really know what to get that excited about, other than that it mostly makes sense. It's pretty good. It could have happened any time. And, look.
So, we were meant to have this kind of big opportunity, as you say. This was meant to be a big opportunity. We were meant to be, as you say, sort of more of a buccaneering nation, and the City of London was going to be at the heart of that. Yet the Boris Johnson administration was never interested in the City of London in any shape or form. I guess we should be maybe happy that at least this current government is showing some interest. But nevertheless, the City of London is being playing defence. I don't see that this is going to put it into offence.
Correct. And in some senses, as I said, a lot of this stuff is going on in Europe sort of anyway. So it's just, the MiFID II reforms were pretty heinous for the city. Some of the stuff a lot of stuff wasn't adopted by Europe, really, and they're unwinding what other stuff. It's just, in some senses, we can almost argue we're getting closer. Equally, it's all relatively sensible. The Solvency II stuff, they've had to get a little bit busy with the regulator. I note the Bank of England is proposing some other reforms which are a little bit more gold-plated and stricter than perhaps the government might have wanted. We'll see how that plays out. But none of this is happening immediately. A lot of this stuff is in consultation. It will probably happen over the course of next year. But, I suppose the only thing I could say is at least they're not doing anything wild and rash, which is upsetting the regulators, obviously. And something that, the next government, even when it may will be the Labour government in 2 years' time, would have unwound. So in that sense, I suppose the city can sort of breathe that it hasn't been too revolutionary. If you speak to any, business manager in the city, all they want is continuity, not that the rules to be changed constantly and to make things, less difficult. I suppose that just about ticks the box.
So where does this all leave the City of London? It has... lost out to continental peers as a result of Brexit. It's lost out to New York. What do you think the future looks like here?
Okay, so I'm going to try and breathe very carefully here. Some of the reporting across the media of the city's demise is somehow proven not to be the case.
Sure, this isn't terminal decline, but it's not
it's actually
the
doing rather well.
It okay. Could it you have know, been doing better? Up. Could it have been doing better?
Look,
silence.
Not really. It's done pretty well in diversifying away from just relying on Europe. Europe has been a tricky market, which was over-concentrated in London, which wasn't good for anyone's health. I still think the main battle has been won, which the European Commission has gone on about it this week, actually, trying to get clearinghouse and derivatives clearing back into Europe. That is not going to happen. But that she's still pulling and pushing Mairead McGuinness on that. It's never going to happen because it just simply doesn't work. It's about time the city got a little bit more efficient and a little bit sort of what works for us, which is what these reforms are sort of all about. Just as it happens, as I keep on saying, Europe is doing the sort of same anyway. That may mean it's easier to do business. In the day, you know, you want to be able to do business easily across continents, across all different types of regimes. And that, I suppose, is what we've been holding ourselves back. And I perhaps at the margin, this makes it more efficient. Could we have done better? I think we've done perfectly well over the last few years in the city. There ought to have been some natural moving across to Europe to make everything more efficient. And then the day Europeans have been stood the wheel for the last two decades, glad they're catching up.
I don't think the threat is Europe. The threat has always been New York. And in some ways, you talk to people in New York. I talk to my colleagues. I talk to the friends that work in finance over there. They see certainly New York having become more preeminent as a result of the fact that the UK has been unfocused on financial services over the last few years.
I think it's become more preeminent because there's so much more business, so much larger growth in the economy and so much more strength all around in the dollar and US stock markets and the SPAC thing and in all the various other different tech-led stuff. I think it's at the margin whether or not London has done better or worse. As far as I'm concerned, you know, where people get it wrong is they look at the fact that trades are booked, perhaps possibly through Amsterdam or the derivative stuff is booked in the US. It's meaningless. It's where the trade really happens. And as far as most global derivatives are concerned and foreign exchange and a raft of other different things, London is still the number one. And it's still where the money is made and the decisions are made and the people are employed. And, you know, in that sense, you know, compared to the US economy, the economy of Europe and the UK have been completely subservient. In that sense, understandably, more money is going to be made and more emphasis. But the trouble with the US and Wall Street, wherever it may be, is it's got more domestically focused because there's no point, you know, doing emerging market business so much. There's less point in doing so much Asia business and likewise European business. So I'm not sure it makes much difference.
I guess the point that I'm trying to make is actually it's been the lack of interest that I think has been the most frustrating part of this. The last few governments have just not been interested in the City of London, and that's why in some ways actually I'm taking today as a positive. At least there's some effort being made in a way that we simply haven't seen from any of the kind of the previous Tory governments over the last few years.
I hear you very much that. Look, you've never had a more experienced, you know, he's got an MBA from Stanford and really exceptional city experience in a prime minister than Rishi Sunak. And that's starting to show. At the same time, you know, Jeremy Hunt is no slouch on that point, and they're both focused on doing sensible things. It's a shame that Rishi himself didn't do a lot of this when he was Chancellor. But as you quite rightly said, perhaps the emphasis of the you know of Boris was in a different angle. It is about time. But you know this is very gentle stuff, and we as long as we take the regulator and they need to change and adapt. But you clearly, as we saw in September, you can't force them or belittle them. Then hopefully we will get a better approach. But we've got to have everyone working together. That's the industry, the regulator, and the government.
What do you think was missing today?
Well, I think there could have been a bit more emphasis on, you know, on properly unwinding MiFID II. There could have been a bit more emphasis perhaps on strengthening and clarifying where the direction of travel for regulation really is. Because, you know, we've had various different spats. We've got perhaps an overly strong FCA, which, you know, created a lot of the MiFID II reforms in the first place. And I think they could do with a bit of a shake-up. We know the Prudential Regulatory Authority could do with a bit of shake-up. We've seen that with regards to the Solvency II issues, with regards to you know, insurance market and investing in infrastructure. I mean, in some senses, there were a few missed opportunities, but really, you know, 2 years to run in this government, they perhaps chose to just do what they could do without listening, you know, again, aggravating a whole hornet's nest.
Marcus, up next, we're going to talk about cars. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
China is the biggest car market in the world. In fact, if you look at the size of the Chinese market, it's actually bigger than if you put United States and EU together. So what happens in China matters for the auto industry and, of course, matters for Mercedes-Benz. I can now see that the central government is trying to put some stimulus into that and see if they can restart the economy together with opening up. So glass half full, 23 could get maybe better.
Ola Hallenius, he is the CEO of Mercedes-Benz, talking to the surveillance team a little bit earlier on, just reinforcing the importance of the Chinese market to Mercedes-Benz and so many other car companies. Tesla, in many ways, in the EV market, was a trailblazer in China. It has a plant there in Shanghai that has been hugely important to making inroads into that market. But there are slight wobbles now starting to appear in that strategy. We've now learned that Tesla will suspend output in stages. It's going to be staged over the next few weeks at that Shanghai plant until the end of the month. We think that potentially this shutdown could last as long as January. Now, the big question here is whether or not this is just a kind of Chinese New Year opportunity, holiday period to maybe fix the production line. Like these are kind of difficult beasts to wrangle, and often there are things that you want to do and work on. Or is this actually a bigger demand story, a slowdown story that maybe has a bigger, more long-term impact? Craig Trudell, Bloomberg Global News Czar, joins us now to talk about this. Craig, which one of those two do you think this is? We're going to see this kind of stage shutdown in Shanghai for Tesla. Is this just regular fixing of bits of kit they need to work on, or is this something maybe a little bit more sinister? Craig Trudell, it does sound like as if Craig might not be there, Marcus. What do you make of what is happening in China?
The great thing about what's going on in China is we have absolutely no idea, and this is why I always struggle with people invest at loan, you know, big companies like Caterpillar, we got burnt so horribly, you know, a decade ago, and no one seems to really learn. But, you know, for someone like, for instance, Volkswagen, who made, you know, multi-billion commitments, and clearly Tesla in this instance here, they've got a very big commitment to China, which is, in theory, a fantastic trade, because the burgeoning middle class will make all their dreams come true until issues like this arrive. And I don't know is the honest answer. I mean, it's quite clear there are some issues here in China, and, you know, stopping production when, and as you quite rightly say, they've got a window to do perhaps maintenance work or revamping of the production line later in January when it's the Golden Week there. I mean, it's sorry, the you know, celebrations that they've got this coming right now, right with what's going on. It does make, you know, people like to delay, you know, accounts for the year. It's always a bit suspicious, isn't it?
Absolutely. We've found Craig Trudell. We can all breathe a little easier now. Craig Trudell, Bloomberg News Global Car Czar, joining us on this story. Craig, let's talk a little bit about what is happening. Marcus and I are just kicking around the idea that maybe actually this is just regular maintenance being performed on the Tesla factory. It's been running at full steam for a really quite a long period of time. Maybe they're just taking the opportunity to fix a few things. Or is this actually something a bit more serious? Maybe is this about demand?
Yeah, I think the fact that they recently did some upgrades and equipment maintenance to the plant suggests to me that this is more than just that. I think this is a matter of you know, some problems that aren't necessarily, you know, Tesla specific. We actually saw, you know, for the month of November, sales industry wide down 9.5% year over year. down 10.5% from October. So, you know, a real hit to demand in the month of November. And obviously, we've seen some of these, sporadic lockdowns and, you know, carry on into December. So, you know, some of the things that are hitting Tesla are, of course, hitting other car makers. And I think there's also a real concern about, you know, a drop off, into the new year. Until and unless we hear from the government in China that they're going to extend some of the support that they've extended to the electric vehicle industry, there's a real, sort of question mark as to whether or not that will be extended. There is some speculation that maybe, we'll have another year of that support. But right now, you know, the plan is for that to be, you know, pulled away in 2023. And as long as that's the case, there's reason to be concerned, going into the new year.
So, Craig, I mean, you know, trying to separate away, probably not possible from the lockdowns. Is this a drop off in demand, which is really very worrying? I mean, a 10% drop or whatever it was is pretty large. I mean, some of it could be delayed demand, you know, coming through because of these lockdowns. Or is this really actually a sign of economic weakness that we really must be paying much more serious attention to?
Yeah, I think it's some demand issues in China. I also wouldn't necessarily discount demand issues elsewhere. And you know, one other factor that hasn't necessarily gotten a ton of attention is the fact that this became such an important source of exports for Tesla, and including over here in Europe, right? So they were shipping quite a lot of Model 3s from the Shanghai plant to Europe. They've ramped up production in Germany. The need to source Model Ys from that factory is not what it was before. So that's another factor to consider here. This is not just a plant just for the domestic market. It really became, you know, more than that over the last year plus. So, this is a case where, you know, it was a factory that, you know, underwent some recent work to really boost production quite a bit. And, you know, the sort of expectation that, strong demand and long wait list was going to last forever, you know, clearly has not panned out. We've seen, you know, the wait times for a Tesla drop dramatically over the last, you know, I would say 4 or 5 months.
I've got 30 seconds left. Craig, how price sensitive is the market here? If we see, like other car companies, prices coming down rapidly, is that going to stimulate demand?
I think that's a really good question, actually, because I think Tesla, you know, does have quite strong pricing. So there is room to bring that down and stimulate demand. And there may be quite a bit more demand if they do come down some more.
Worth the wait. Craig, always a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed. Bloomberg's Craig Trudell on what is happening with Tesla out in Shanghai. Up next, we're going to talk more about what is happening next week. Big week for central banks. We're going to kick it off with the Bank of England. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome. You're listening to The Cable. We're live on DAB Digital Radio. I'm Guy Johnson in London, alongside this evening Marcus Ashworth of Bloomberg Opinion. Alex Steele has the day off. Let's talk about where we are with the price action right now. This is The Cable, so let's start there. The pound having a relatively good day today, certainly against the US dollar, 122.87. A little earlier, we had a little look north of 123. I was talking to Derek Halpeny of MUFG a little bit earlier on, suggesting maybe what we now see, though, with a difficult winter ahead for the UK, is a drift down towards kind of the 115 level. In terms of the equity markets, we saw the FTSE 100 today closing fairly flat, 74.76. We have seen oil stocks under a little bit of pressure today. But over in the United States right now, we've got a fairly flat session underway. The S&P is up by 0.1%. The NASDAQ's up by around 0.3%. Everybody's really kind of looking forward into next week, trying to figure out what the big moves are going to be. We've got a whole series of central banks. We'll talk about those next. They're going to be meeting. Plus, we've got a whole load of inflation data as well to factor into the equation. So that's what we're going to do over the next 30 minutes. We're going to talk about and try and set you up for some of those meetings that are going to take place. It's the last real big week of the year. Are we about to go out with a bang? Well, let's figure out what's happening right now with Charlie Pellett.
Here's what's going on. Let us begin with that difficult winter ahead that you were alluding to, Guy. The UK's Met Office has issued a warning for snow and ice in southeast England and London beginning Sunday morning. As much as 10 centimeters of snow may accumulate in some places, potentially causing travel delays and power cuts. The cold snap and low wind speeds are testing Europe's winter resilience as costly energy rattles the economy and drives up inflation. Santander UK has been fined £108 million by the financial watchdog, the UK financial watchdog, over repeated anti-money laundering failures that included a series of missteps over its monitoring of hundreds of millions of pounds of suspicious funds. The bank, according to the Financial Conduct Authority, said the bank had serious and persistent gaps in its oversight of business customers over a five-year period through 2017. ITV's broadcast of England's World Cup quarterfinal against France tomorrow is a golden opportunity for Britain's largest free-to-air TV network and could mark one of the largest sporting events in recent years. It is the last big match in the tournament to which London-based ITV has exclusive rights to. The company shares UK rights to FIFA Qatar 2022 with the BBC, but the BBC does have the first pick of the semi-finals and has ad-free offerings that historically have attracted larger audiences for international football finals. That is the latest from the news desk. Guy Johnson, back to you now in London.
Charlie Pellett, thank you very much indeed. I'd like to point out as well, thank you very much indeed, Charlie. I'd like to point out that currently it is now 1-1, Croatia versus Brazil. Extra time, 28 minutes, the Croatians score after the Brazilians went ahead in extra time. Is this one heading for penalties? Are we about to see a potential surprise? Brazil, the firm favourites right now, but maybe struggling a little bit against Croatia. Anyway, I will keep you updated with what is happening there. Quick conversation about these central banks, I think, is now justified. Next week is a kind of huge week. We've got the Bank of England, we've got the ECB, the European Central Bank, and of course the Federal Reserve, all out with decisions. There's a whole load of other meetings as well. The Norge Bank, for instance, the SNB, both have decisions that they need to be making as well. But let's start at home. Let's start with the Bank of England and talk more about what we could get from Governor Bailey and co. Marcus, it appears as if the central kind of expectation is that we get a 50 basis point hike, a half a percent hike from the Bank of England. But nobody's quite prepared to rule out 25, and nobody's quite prepared to rule out 75 either.
Well, the reason is that we might get a four, or even possibly five-way split amongst the nine members. From what we know, starting on the dovish side, Sylvia Tenreiro was voted only for 25 last time. She may even vote for no change. Then the newest member, Swati Dhingra, was also, you know, perhaps on the dovish side. We expect her possibly to only vote for 25. The bulk, however big that bulk may be, will probably vote for 50. And then you could well have a couple of the hawkish ones voting for 75 still. You know, I watched Randon speak the other day. And though he did throw in a little, you know, vignette that maybe if inflation came down, they could cut rates at some point. I don't think that was on his front and centre as an agenda. I think he's still very much wanting to keep on hiking quite hard. So the question is, do the bulk of the, you know, swing it to 50? I think the way that divide is, it's almost certainly will settle at 50. And that's why the thing is that can you have a hawkish hike when it's 50 basis points? Well, I suppose you can. In the sense that it's not 75, but how aggressive they say they're going to carry on hiking is really what people are looking for. It's that forward guidance, which they don't really give us anymore, but in essence, they are going to have to a bit. It's whether or not this is 50 and there might be one more 25 and that's them done, which is sort of where I expect Bank of England rates to settle out about 375 from the current 3%. Or they're going to say, no, we're going to give you 50, but the next time, you know, probably give you another 50 and we might do another one. And that would be hawkish. And that, I think, is where the risks are to bond prices.
The reason potentially for that more hawkish tilt would be what is happening in the labour market. The demand story looks like it is softening up. But this is a labour market that I think is incredibly tight and likely to remain incredibly tight. There's a number of factors kind of behind this. What is happening with people leaving the labour market, the lack of immigration that the UK is experiencing at the moment, et cetera, et cetera. How concerned do you think the Bank of England is going to have to be that it's going to have to continue to kind of lean on that, that basically this is an economy, given where the labour market is, that needs to run significantly slower?
Well, this is the divergence, I think, between, as I mentioned, Ramsden, who's deputy governor, who would normally expect to be in the pack and backing very much what Andrew Bailey. Andrew Bailey is giving, you know, vibes of like, let's not overdo it here. We've got a recession coming.
Yep.
You know, obviously, full employment means that the recession is unlikely to be very deep at the moment. But nonetheless, you know, Ramsden is much more concerned about ongoing shortages in labour and therefore ongoing inflation. And I think that's the problem here, is that we've seen four lower prints in US inflation. We have yet to see one clearly coming through in the UK. We did see one in Europe. We do have our own slight difficulties with the way our energy pricing works here, but you know, we would really like to see a lower CPI number. And then from then we can see we're probably like the rest of the world, we're sort of peaked out. But that's the reason why we're going to do 50, not 75, probably.
What about the housing market? We've got a minute left. What do you think about the housing market data starting to drop fairly precipitously?
It just drives me mad, this. You know, what do you expect after the last 2 months of shenanigans with the government? It's just catch up. The key issue is we closed early for Christmas. Applications have dropped, as you'd expect. Approvals are still strong. Look at the current mortgage rates, which are super aggressive compared to where the bank rate is. Banks are wanting to lend again. Let's wait for the spring. I think by surprise, things will recover substantially. We are going to get some froth off the top. The year-on-year rate is going to go slightly negative. That's just the way the basis effect works. Will we have an actual house price slump in this country like everyone seems to think with? I don't think so.
Okay. Marcus has some experience of house price slumps. Always makes him very, very nervous. Can I just say, full-time, Croatia 1, Brazil 1. Croatia surprising. This could be interesting considering just how well their goalkeeper has been playing as we head towards penalties. I will keep you updated. The ECB's next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
One central bank down, two to go. Let's talk a little bit about the ECB and what we should expect from the European Central Bank next week. Again, the expectation is that we are going to see a 50 basis point hike from Christine Lagarde and co. One of the questions is whether or not we're going to see a firm date for the start of quantitative tightening, i.e. the running off of the balance sheet. Remember, the Bank of England has already started that and the Fed has already started that. Are we about to see something similar from the ECB? Joining us now to discuss, David Powell, Senior Euro Area Economist for Bloomberg Economics. David, what is the central case? What are we expecting from the ECB next week?
Well, the 50 basis point hike is basically a done deal. The financial markets are not even pricing in much chance of a larger move. And that's because there seems to be broad consensus. The hawks on the governing council even seem to be okay with 50 basis points. No one's really calling for 75 basis points, except maybe one or two people. And so that seems like a done deal. The real debate is going to be around quantitative tightening. We already know from what Christine Lagarde has told us most recently in testimony before the European Parliament that they're going to release broad principles of quantitative tightening in December. We don't know which details exactly they will release, but I think what the market's going to be focusing on is two things. One is timing. When exactly will it start? There doesn't seem to be consensus around that, with the hawks saying the beginning of the year. We had the central bank governor from Ireland on Bloomberg TV this week, and he said he favors the end of Q1, start of Q2. And then there's also the exact amount that they're going to do. Perhaps the easiest thing for them to do would just be to allow the bonds that are maturing from the asset purchase program to completely run off. And we know from the data they published that's about 60 billion euros a month on average for the next 12 months.
I don't think, David, we'll get 60 billion. Let's say it starts April 1st. We might get, as the Fed did, and probably so sensibly, say 20, then a lift up to 40, then a lift up to 60. I guess that's how they'll do it. But one quick thing other than that is the Teltros, these targeted longer-term refinancing operations. We saw another, you know, payback from the banks, commercial banks, back to the European Central Bank today. It brings to about 800 billion so far. They've collapsed. How does that, you know, drop in the balance sheet at the same time as they're contemplating QT, how does that all work together? Is that an issue, or do you think, from where you're saying, the ECB is sort of on top of this and they're allowing it steadily to, you know, balance off against each other?
Well, both of these activities, the rolling off of bonds, as well as the returning of cash borrowed through TLTROs, they do the same thing. They reduce liquidity in the economy. They reduce the monetary base to fund both of those. The ECB printed money, and as that money goes back to the ECB, there's less liquidity. So they accomplish similar things. Today's announcement showed that about one-fourth of the outstanding balance going into today's announcement is going to be repaid. That's a large number. That may allow the doves to say, we don't need to be as aggressive as we may have been if that number had been smaller in terms of the rolling off of bonds. So we'll see that. But I think we have to remember, too, the bond program is much larger than TLTROs. Going into today's announcement, the outstanding balance was only about 21% of the ECB's balance sheet. So really, the big game is still the bond portfolios on the balance sheet.
Final quick question, got about a minute left. We have seen thus far in this tightening cycle very little stress in the BTP market. We're about to add potentially QT to the process as well. Is that where we should look potentially for risks as this process unfolds?
It is. And not only do we have those things, we also have the huge funding needs of European governments at the start of the year who have announced a lot of support programs to cap energy prices. And those are going to cost several hundred billion euros to fund. So this winter, they're going to have large funding needs. And maybe that is a reason the ECB will wait to the end of the quarter, or as Marcus suggested, go for a smaller amount at the start, at least until we get through the winter.
Great stuff, David. As ever, thank you very much indeed. We'll look forward to the coverage next week. Bloomberg's David Powell on the ECB. And then we turn to the United States. Next week, we have inflation data, as we have here, out of the US. That could be huge. We've also got the Fed Wednesday. That could be huge. Mike McKee joins us next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. Quick comment on the football. Bit of a shocker. Croatia have just knocked Brazil, one of the firm favourites for winning this competition, out. Croatia 4, Brazil 2 in penalties. They missed two, or there were two saved. One saved, one hit the post. Amazing. This competition keeps throwing up surprises, and some of the big giants of global football are increasingly going home. Germany out. We've seen Spain out. Now Brazil is out. Absolutely amazing. And this is going to throw up a really interesting side to that side of the tournament as we go into this weekend. Croatia into the semi-finals. Anyway, I digress. Soon to be France out. We'll see. Yeah. Well, that would make life even more interesting, wouldn't it? Let's talk about what comes. Mark, I didn't have you down as a football fan.
Soccer ball, I'm not, but this has got nothing to do with football.
No, it doesn't. It's about national pride. The Brazilians are not going to be feeling good about themselves right now. Anyway, Mike McKee is sitting patiently waiting to talk to us about the Federal Reserve and CPI. Mike, the two big events, Tuesday CPI, Wednesday the Federal Reserve. I was talking to one of our guests on Bloomberg Television a little bit earlier on from MUFD, Derek Halpin, and he was saying, If you get a soft CPI number, inflation number on Tuesday, and then a hawkish sounding Fed on the Thursday, the market will ignore the hawkish sounding Fed and focus instead on the data. Is the data more important than the central bank next week?
I don't think so. I think, and the reason being is the CPI comes first. So Jay Powell will have an opportunity in his news conference to steer the analysis of the CPI. And I don't think the CPI is going to change what the Fed thinks it's going to do. And the Fed is planning on moving higher. New survey of economists by Bloomberg today shows that basically Wall Street is now on board with 5% as a terminal rate. And the Wall Street economists are also on board with the idea of leaving it there for a year. So if you get a marginal increase in CPI, the general consensus, I think, is that it has peaked. So I don't think it really affects people as much. Maybe you get a huge upside surprise, but I don't think it has as much influence as Powell could have.
Mike, it just seems to me, I mean, looking at two charts, one's just simply the price of oil, which is, despite everyone talking oil to going to the moon and this and that, is it's at the low of the year and falling fast. At the same time, you look at CPI and PPI in China, and it's just plummeting. So the market in the US, when you've got 10-year bond yields at 3.5, give or take, is just looking, it seems, through the Fed, past whatever Powell says, and ignoring him. Who's going to win this battle? Is the Fed just going to keep on at it, applying pain? And at this rate, I can't even see 5% as realistic. Certainly not for a year. Keeping there for a year, to my mind, is for the birds.
Well, I'll tell you what I think about this is that the Fed is determined to bring down inflation and won't back off. That doesn't mean they couldn't change their mind if there was some sort of exogenous event that really sent the U.S. economy spiraling down. But the fact that it may affect other countries isn't going to really bother them. I think that they aren't they're saying they're going to keep the rate unchanged throughout 2023. I don't think they necessarily anticipate they will have to do that. They think inflation is going to go down, as most economists do, and go down fairly quickly. So it is possible by the end of the year that the inflation dynamic changes. However, we've seen with the markets, they want to grab onto any sign of dovishness that they can. And so yeah. There's nothing in it for the Fed to say, well, probably June, July, we'll rethink this. It works best for them to just leave it as a year-long thing.
Isn't monetary policy for the U.S. economy already being eased? As Marcus says, oil prices are down. Mortgage rates are falling. You have gas prices coming down. I mentioned that on the oil side, but kind of gas prices are coming down as well. You've got a whole sort of series of events. The bond market is coming lower. Equity markets are looking a little rosy. All of these things point to an easing of financial conditions in the United States. Is the Fed comfortable with that?
They don't want the financial conditions to ease a whole lot more. They know that they will to a certain extent when you get reasonably good news on economic variables. Nobody can predict what's going to happen with oil. But for right now, the news is good. And so the Fed is going to look at it as, we're going to stay on our path and adjust our path as we feel necessary. Obviously, they could start talking more hawkishly, and it may be that Jay Powell does, because we've seen this decrease in financial conditions. But if it just stays kind of about where it is, I think they won't worry about it too much.
I have to say, Biden's decision to open the Strategic Petroleum Reserve just seemed rather geniusly timed. Obviously, it was convenient before the midterms, but as far as calling the oil market is concerned, it's better to be lucky than clever. I feel a bit sorry for Jay Powell the other way around, in the sense that, whatever he says, he clearly wants to keep the pressure on the stock market, and he wants bond yields, should we say, to be at least 50 basis points higher, and the stock market not to have gone up. And neither seem to be listening to him. And I wonder if it's sort of just, shouting in the wind, whether or not he's going to lose the credibility. But yep. I agree with you in some sense. He's got to keep it up. He's got to keep the hawkish rhetoric going.
Well, he keeps credibility if they stay on the path. What the market's going to look for is any kind of wobble, and we've seen this every time he comes out and speaks. Every time the Fed has a meeting, it's read it the way you want to read it. Is the way it works out.
Mike, great stuff. Always a pleasure. Looking forward to the coverage next week. busy, busy week coming up next week. Mike McKee, thank you. Marcus Ashworth, thank you. Have a great weekend. We'll see how the football goes. But Croatia go to the semi-finals. That's the big news of the last few minutes. This is Bloomberg.